Welcome back to the Anglo-Omani Society podcast. Today I'm excited to welcome Dr. Smitty Nathan, an archaeologist who researches ancient communities and people in the Al-Dahira Governorate in northern Oman and has been working with the Archaeological Water Histories of Oman project. She is particularly interested in the choices ancient people made regarding food, water, and other resources. Her recent work also focuses on making archaeological research and findings more accessible to broader audiences. Today we sat down to discuss the project, Archaeology in Oman, and how an archaeologist's work is never done. I really hope you enjoy listening. Thank you so much, Smitty, for joining me today. We connected via Twitter over an article I wrote on Omani food, actually, and I loved how you were all the way in Baltimore, USA, but still in love with Oman the same way I am. So please, could you actually start by telling our listeners a bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me. And as Dina mentioned, my name is Smitty Nathan. I'm an archaeologist. I'm American born and raised, U.S. in particular. And my family is of Indian descent, specifically from Kerala in India. And as an archaeologist, I'm really interested in the general question of like, why do people make the decisions they do? And in my research and studies, that has materialized into trying to understand a bit more about where people live and why they choose certain locations, what they eat, and why they choose certain like plants, foods, or animals, or other resources, and you know what resources people use and why. And yeah, that's a bit about my archaeological interest in general. I'm not a traditional academic archaeologist. I did academia for a bit, and then I decided like, hey, like, you know, I want to explore doing research in different settings, but still doing archaeology. So I'm currently a UX researcher for a private company in the US, but I still avidly pursue my archaeological research. And other than that, I'm currently living in Baltimore with my son, and who's 2.5, and my husband. And yeah, that's a bit about me.
Thank you so much, Smitty. So I have a question. So essentially, I love how you actually dabble in archaeology, but that's not your full-time thing. Usually I'd expect that to just be someone's whole entire thing. So that's really cool that you're able to do both. So would you say you're more on would you consider yourself almost an anthropologist too?
That's what my degree technically states. So my doctorate degree is technically in anthropology. And so in the US, if you want to pursue archaeology, especially in graduate studies, there's different paths. So you can go the anthropology route and like study up archaeology by getting a degree in anthropology. And it's typically a four-field approach. So that is anthropology, a sociocultural anthropology, archaeology, biological anthropology, and linguistic anthropology. And this is very much like the US tradition of anthropology. Now, you can also go more of a regional studies route in terms of learning about and studying archaeology. So, for example, you could do Egyptology or classical studies or Near Eastern studies. That's also a common route. But unlike in the UK and many parts of Europe, there are very, very few programs in the US where you can get a doctorate directly in archaeology. So yes, I am technically an anthropologist. I'm very much so anthropologically trained. So I think our program at NYU, New York University, advertised itself as like anthropological archaeology. So I guess that's a happy medium.
Oh, wow. That's so fascinating. I love it. Definitely very fascinated by what you got to study.
Oh, thank you.
So, I mean, you're all the way in Baltimore. How does one come to first learn about Oman? And when was your first visit?
So even though I live in Baltimore right now, I only moved here about 3 years ago. And I actually learned about Oman when I was doing archaeological work in Ethiopia. So that's lots of traveling going on. So where that started was when I started my doctoral degree at New York University in 2011. I think that's correct. What is time these days? I was really interested in working around the Indian Ocean region, and I was really open to the country. I was just really fascinated in that larger region, which at that time was like quite understudied. And in terms of, you know, professionalizing in the field, at that time, it was really important to make sure you could get on a field project and do field work. So in exploring different projects, I was able to get on a project in Ethiopia, specifically in the Tigray region with Dr. Michael Harrower. And so I worked with him one summer in Ethiopia. And then he also works in Oman. And he asked me if I could come help him lead a survey out in Oman the following winter. And I said yes. And that's how I first came to learn about Oman. And my first visit, which was also coincided with field work, was spending a month in Oman in January of 2013.
Wow, that is incredible. So that's really, really fascinating to hear. Please could you tell us a bit more about the archaeological water histories of Oman?
Yeah, sure. So that project, which we call ARHU, I guess that's the acronym there, was founded by Dr. Michael Harrower, who is the principal investigator for that project. And it started, I believe, in 2011, but I could be mistaken. It could be 2009. I sometimes get the our projects, Ethiopia and Oman projects, confused in terms of timelines. But it's been going on for well over a decade, and we do a mix of a survey and excavation and just understanding the Omani landscape, specifically in the archaeological landscape, specifically in the Yanqul area of northern Oman and the Adahira governorate.
So that's really fascinating. So who established this project, and why was Oman specifically on their radar for investigating water and trade?
Sure. So it was Dr. Michael Harrower who established this project. That is his project. And I feel very fortunate that I can work on that project and I can continue to work with that team. And he originally did his dissertation in Yemen, and his dissertation advisor also worked in Yemen, and I think also established doing some work in Oman. So I think he was introduced to Oman via his dissertation advisor, who is Dr. Joy McCorriston. And you would have to ask Mike himself directly about this, but since working with him, he has been really interested in water and the role it plays in ancient societies.
That's so interesting. That's really specific, and I don't think I'd ever go, I'm interested in water, but I guess water is like the most important thing,
right,
for all of us. But yeah, we never think that deep. That's really, really fascinating. So I kind of on that, for people like me who have no understanding of this subject, could you explain a bit more about what water politics means?
Yeah, no problem. So I'll be completely honest. Like when I was thinking about this, I was like, oh, okay, how do I break down this, this concept that is like so integral to my research for like the past 10 plus years. But if you break it down, like water politics itself is the politics surrounding the availability of water and water resources. And if we're going off the same Wikipedia definition of politics, like we're thinking of activities associated with the governance of a country or another area. So when we're thinking about that, especially with Oman and throughout its history, you know, water politics pops up. And it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, a negative connotation. I think sometimes when we hear the word politics, we're like, oh, that's a bad thing. But not necessarily. The things that we're interested in are, okay, like, why did certain groups of people or people decide to inhabit a certain area? And that might have to do with the availability of water or certain water resources. And that's like one of the studies that, or part of one of the studies I did for my dissertation. It examined that aspect, especially in the Adahira governorate. Other parts of like water politics could be like, you know, how do people allocate resources. I saw you had Dr. Harriet Nash on one of your podcasts, and I think she is an excellent example of a researcher who studies, you know, like stargazing and how water governance kind of works in the historical period and even like the most recent past and now. And that's all, you know, those are all questions around like, you know, allocating resources and thinking about organizing as a group or a society or organization around water and water resources. So it's quite broad, but very much tied to how does this resource impact people and kind of their lives and social organization.
Okay, that totally makes sense. And I guess viewing Oman from my perspective, whenever I travel, even especially to interior villages, you can obviously see that a lot of them will live around fellages. And, mm-hmm. you know, that stream of water is so important till today, even though, you know, there are better mechanisms of how they get water. I remember visiting one village very close to the border of Saudi, and they were telling me how much they still use the fellages and how important it is for maybe some of the people washing clothes or just feeding all of the farms around them. And it's really fascinating to see, I guess, living in a Western world, you kind of take water for granted, maybe.
Sure. And I think to your point, I did what's called ethnoarchaeology as part of my dissertation. So that's essentially like ethnography for archaeologists. And we're not trying to make like direct correlates to the past, but just trying to better understand, at least for me, how people use certain like resources, especially like the land and water in, you know, what could be a very constraining environment, and just to better understand that landscape. And I'll reference Mike again. He actually wrote a book doing a comparative analysis about the American West and Yemen and like kind of how water and water politics, especially water scarcity, played a role in that. But then going back to kind of the work that I did with ethnoarchaeology in Oman, I talked to a lot of farmers and people who were growing different crops, and I got a better understanding of just like the diversity of water resource access. And sometimes that just had to do with, you know, how certain land areas were composed or their access to water. So, for example, there was one area in Oman where, you know, water access was no issue. They could access water through wells and all was good for their farm. And just like, honestly, a couple kilometers like down the road, another farm was having a lot of issues keeping their date palms alive and watered because of their access to the groundwater wasn't as great because they just didn't have as much groundwater in that area. So it was, even though you might, as some people, when you first like drive around like the landscape in the north, you might be like, oh, it's all the same, but there's actually a lot of like diversity in terms of access.
Wow, that's incredible. That's really interesting. And I mean, like what is this, like all of this research, I mean, it obviously goes into having a better understanding, but does it play useful in anything else? Or is it something we need to know for the future? I mean, or is it just fascinating stuff to learn?
That is a great philosophical question. And it really honestly depends what your question is. I think with access to certain natural resources, especially like resources that aren't renewable. So if you're thinking of certain mining resources, water resources as well, I think the archaeological record is an amazing data set in terms of seeing like how things play out long term. And we see this in like countries, not just in Oman, but like throughout the world. Like if you want to understand maybe like the impact of deforestation over like hundreds or thousands of years, like the archaeological record could be a really compelling resource to start to understand that. If you wanted to understand like, okay, what happens if we just extract water from this area and we do it fairly intensely? If that kind of event happened in the past, perhaps we could understand like the impacts of that. And I think that's a big question in Oman too, you know, water usage. With the advent of motorized pumps, it's, you know, it's much easier to quickly extract water, especially groundwater. But that also can have an impact on different things. Like you might get more salt in your water. There might be other impacts in terms of like minerals entering your water too. And I think if that kind of event occurred in the past, we could study that to get a better idea of the impact of it.
Thank you. That was really interesting. So since starting this project, I know obviously a lot of it is just mainly research and learning and seeing, but what has been probably the most major finding that you've come across?
Ooh, that's a tough question. You know, I would say, honestly, like the unexpected when, and I'll elaborate on that. So typically when you're doing an academic project, you need funding and, you know, you do some background research, you might do some pilot work and you have an idea of what you want to study. But then when you go out in the field and if you're doing survey or if you're doing excavation, you typically might come across something you didn't expect. And I think with Oman, some of our big discoveries, and I'll elaborate on like the word discovery a bit later, but some of our big discoveries were unexpected. We just did not know we were going to uncover and understand what we did. And you know what? I'll go into like the term discovery right now. Oftentimes people might have the understanding that, hey, like archaeologists go to a location, we dig up something, and then we immediately know what it is. It's mm-hmm. typically not the case. Typically what I've seen working in both Oman and Ethiopia is areas that are quite old or might have some archaeological history to them, it's pretty commonly known among the people who live in the area. Not all sites, but you know, a good number of them that I've encountered. But just from looking at a certain location, just seeing what's on the surface, if there's any architecture left behind, we don't immediately know what the significance is. So the discovery mm-hmm. process is not just like instantaneous. It's typically you're looking at different proxies. You're taking in, you know, local community knowledge. You're also taking in like, okay, like the context of where the find was. And then honestly, a lot in what's called like the post-processing process. So doing specific scientific analyses to better understand what we're looking at. This could be radiocarbon dating. This could be other forms of like understanding a certain material. So with the discovery process, it's typically very collaborative and it's long. So it takes a bit of time. But with Oman, to answer your question, I think the major findings for us have been like just really unexpected finds that have changed the trajectory of our research. For example, there's this one site called Akr al-Shamus in northern Oman. And there were two brothers living quite close to the site. And for, I think, years, they've been telling like the Ministry of Heritage and Culture, like, hey, like we think this is an important area. We think this is quite old. Can you come check it out? And one of our collaborators, Suleiman Al-Jabri, he brought various archaeologists to come check it out. And they were like, okay, yeah, like it's old, but you know, like we don't really know what's going on there. And then he brought us out and we were like, hey, there is a lot of like, you know, what's called soft stone or chlorite material here, which was really important, especially in like the Bronze Age period in the region. And we weren't finding finished products, but we were seeing like, you know, these chloride materials at like different stages. And upon analysis, we, you know, came to the conclusion that like, hey, this might be one of like the oldest known chloride manufacturing sites in Arabia. And you know, we worked with the chloride specialist. We, you know, did various analysis of the chloride. We still need to understand the architecture a bit better, but that whole discovery process was very collaborative. You had, you know, our local Omani community members, our local ministry and Ministry of Culture and Heritage representatives, you had local archaeologists, and then you had specialists all looking at the material, which at that point at this site was at the surface, and then, you know, like going through this discovery and analysis process to be like, wow, okay, this is a major finding. And we spend a lot of our time now trying to understand like soft stone resources and Akar al-Shamus as a site and in its setting and maybe sites in that area. And that is one finding that definitely like changed the trajectory of our research.
Wow, that's so fascinating. I think you just encompassed another question there, because I was going to see if anything took you by surprise while you've been doing all of this, but it looks like there's quite a few things that can take you by surprise and be unexpected. So I guess from the outside, you never realize how much or how long the discovery can take. But with that being said, like, how long will this project continue for?
Well, as you mentioned before, like water, it's quite specific, but it's also quite broad. And I think the project will continue as long as, you know, Mike is interested in doing it, and our Omani collaborators and colleagues will have us. So we have different, you know, specific kind of sub projects within like the larger project, and that, you know, typically comes to closing points depending on like where we are with analysis. But the larger project, I think, will continue on for the foreseeable future. We definitely don't have an end date in sight, at least that I'm not aware of.
Well, at least that means more trips to Oman for you.
Oh, yes.
So
yes.
That's very, very good. And I mean, I think you kind of touched on this, but like, are there future aims for what you're currently doing? Or is this more so, okay, Oman is our next destination to cover, let's finish this and then we move on to the next country?
I can't speak for the project, but given it's like the archaeological water histories of Oman project, I think it's very much Omani-based project for our team. I will say personally for me, in terms of my archaeological research, I am very happy working in Oman. And I don't foresee stopping working in Oman anytime soon, even if I can't get to the country, which is the case currently. I mean, I know it's just opened up recently, but there's plenty of like work to do and writing to do in the meantime. So I definitely view Oman as, you know, one of my research homes, and just it's definitely an integral part of like, you know, my most recent past and for sure future. So
yeah. Do you think, like, we probably actually already said this, but like, what would you say kind of Oman's next move within this area would be? Like, do you think from the research you're currently doing, do you almost have like small outcomes along the way where you're advising people in Oman, okay, this is what we've discovered and this is what you should be focusing on or aiming for? Like, is there any, or is this just more so, I know we've kind of explained it's just the research of it, but is there anything that the Omanis will need to take away?
That's a really interesting question, because when I think of our research, like I really view it as like collaborative, like alongside our Omani like colleagues. So we work quite closely with the Ministry of Heritage and Culture. Like, I mean, like logistically, you need to make sure you get, you have to apply through them to get a permit to even do research in the country. And where we are in the Adahira governorate, there is a local Ministry of Heritage and Culture in Bat, Oman, which is, it's a small village, but there is a major UNESCO World Heritage site there. So I don't really view it as like, oh, this is our research, and then like, this is what we, you know, have to tell the Omanis. Like, I mean, this is like, this country is like, it's Oman. It's like, and I feel just very grateful and fortunate that, like, you know, I can work there. And so I view it very much as like working alongside our Omani colleagues So I wouldn't say it's anything we're like telling them or Omanis that they need to do, like this process of, you know, bringing archaeological knowledge to the forefront can materialize in different ways. So for example, as, you know, more, you know, roads are being built or more mining is happening, especially in the Atahir governorate, archaeologists are sometimes brought in to like make sure there is or isn't any archaeology in the area. And if there is, there's a call made whether to preserve the site and like redirect construction around it. Or if construction needs to go through, then we do our best to kind of do what's called like rescue archaeology or salvage archaeology to like record and understand the site before it is essentially like destroyed. But then it can also go a different direction, like with the UNESCO World Heritage Site at Bat El Ain and Al Khutum, in that there could be certain sites that could be really appealing for tourism. And thinking about how to best prepare certain like sites or areas for tourism. And it's not just tourism, I would say, for like, you know, foreigners coming to Oman, but also like, you know, how can Omanis who are like living in the area, you know, enjoy that archaeological space and site while, you know, while the site is being preserved, but also, you know, being an area where like maybe families can gather or where you can like go take a walk. I know archaeological parks are quite common, or I've seen in, I shouldn't say quite common, but mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the archaeological park of Hilli, and that's in the UAE, which is just right across the border. And like mm-hmm. when I visited Hilli, like, yes, it was just so fascinating that the archaeological sites were like preserved and the history was there. But it was also just a place where, you know, families could gather and like picnic, and there were designated areas for that. And I think that, like, not saying that's like a best practice or a bad practice, but I think that's a really interesting like question, like not, you know, how to, you know, preserve archaeological sites while also maybe like creating spaces for people to enjoy, for encouraging tourism, or any other question. So I think these are kind of questions that we are sometimes like brought in by different parts of like the Omani government or projects to consult about. So
okay, very, very interesting. So thank you. No, you definitely summed that up, and I'm really glad that it's all collaborative. That's a refreshing thing to hear.
Well, that's like my view on it. I can't speak for all archaeologists, but I really hope that's like the case. And I think I have to say, yeah. I think the Omanis do a good job in terms of like, hey, okay, like tell us about what projects you're doing, like in order to get a permit. Like they have the Journal of Oman Studies, which you are required to publish in before, like, you know, publishing major findings elsewhere, unless you get permission. So I think Oman is making a really strong effort in kind of creating that infrastructure for collaboration.
No, indeed, indeed they are. So on the subject of kind of excavating and what happens, I was reading an article on the Library of Congress. This is the first time I've ever been to this website, so it's me doing my background research. And it was about a symposium they held with Sultan Qaboos Cultural Center on mm-hmm. ancient Oman archaeological digs and historical discoveries in the Sultanate of Oman. And there were like various panels that were held on the findings of Oman. And however, there was a third panel that focused on contemporary Oman, and a panelist called Nathan Rayner from SQCC, who's a research fellow, discussed how archaeology is affecting the country and how we need to preserve Oman's rich culture. Now, from the kind of physical aspect of this, I'm assuming that from the excavations that are done, could you like kind of explain, like, obviously I essentially assume they're digging up the country, so they're ruining that part of landscape. But is there a way to meet in the middle to discover and preserve?
Yeah, sure. So I completely hear you. And like, you know, the excavation part of archaeology is absolutely a destructive science. Once you dig up, you know, even any plot of land or any area, you can't really put it back the way it was. So it's important to, of course, like dig very carefully. Recording is very essential in archaeology. So this could be like taking detailed notes, recording locations meticulously, taking photographs. So as we're peeling back and uncovering layers, layer by layer, and essentially as those layers are destroyed, as we're understanding them, we are preserving that history. So in terms of your question of meeting in the middle, I think what's good to keep in mind as well is that like there's a lot of structures, architectural structures that are already on like the surface that you can kind of see in Oman that might not necessarily involve a lot of digging or very deep digging. And, you know, it's very context specific. So when we're thinking of certain above ground tombs, specifically maybe from like the Hafit period, which is like the earliest Bronze Age period, followed by the Umanar period, most of those tombs are like above ground. So you might dig a little bit if there was some, you know, accumulation, but those kind of structures are already on the landscape. And then when we think about like maybe more contemporary structures, like a lot of like the mud brick structures that we see in date palm oases, those might be in, you know, varying states, but they're already there. Now, in terms of, you know, perhaps like archaeological sites that are underground, I think what typically happens is, you know, you need to have a permit. You need to have the okay to, you know, dig a site. And especially if that site is on someone's land or if that's, you know, obstructing like maybe a major construction project or what have you, I think the way my experience has been so far is that we just don't go digging lightly. And I think our team, especially, we're very conscientious of not coming in with like a colonialist attitude and saying like, okay, well, this is important for archaeology, so we're going to dig it up and we don't care if like your date palm farm is here. Like, absolutely not. So when we're deciding on an area to dig, a lot of thought and forethought goes into it. And actually a lot of like scientific prospecting techniques, which means that, you know, we might, especially our project, like we look at various different types of satellite imagery and remotely sensed imagery to see if an area is worth digging at. And what I mean by worth digging at is I wouldn't want to just go dig up random plots. I wouldn't want to just go dig random holes. Like that's not good for anyone. So typically, before, remote sensing and satellite imagery and other prospecting techniques, what was a good indicator that there might be an archaeological site is if you see some remnants of architecture. And so you're like, okay, maybe there's something there. So we'll start with what we know and then dig from there. Now, with remote sensing techniques, you can use various proxies and signals to get an idea of what might be happening underground. And that could be an indicator of an area worth digging. So long story short, that was a big explanation to say that, yes, archaeology is a destructive science. And I think it's imperative, especially for archaeologists, to remember that as we are thinking about how we are recording and preserving sites, but also choosing which sites to do further research on.
Okay, amazing. Well, that's nice to know how you guys go about it, and that there is, I guess, some consideration. It's just always one of those things. There's work to be done, but how do we maintain as well? Thank you. Okay, on obviously the subject of discovering things, the article also mentions Michael, who is obviously the director of Archaeological Water Histories of Oman. And he mentioned how he used satellite imagery mapping to find objects and identify materials. And apparently he discovered or has been discovering areas that have show signs of copper and regions where that trees had been burnt from charcoal during the Bronze Age. He also identified more recent items from the Dhofar region, such as metal tools, weapons including daggers, and household utensils such as spatulas. He also located semi-precious beads such as the carnelian beads. And I mean, like, this is so incredible. And to be fair, since I love food, the main thing that actually made me go, wow, was the utensils and spatulas, right, of everything. I was like, oh, I need to know about this. So like, while it's all amazing, could you explain, like, what does that kind of mean for the country and to an archaeologist and to third parties who now know this information of Oman? Does it then suddenly go, okay, well, we've discovered, for instance, spatulas in Oman that were from a certain period in time. So what do we start excavating and trying to figure out why they were, like, it sounds weird when I say it out loud, but I feel like there's always a why with archaeologists, right? Why was that discovered there and why in that period of time? So he's discovered these great things, but obviously they're not to do with water, but will that and then encourage to go on to something else?
So short answer, yes. I was kind of laughing to myself when you were asking do archaeologists just ask why all the time? And I'm like, that's what I literally hear at my day job. They're like, oh, you're the why person. I'm like, yeah, that's my training. So yeah, I to your question, it really just depends on the question. Let's say you dig at a site and you uncover a bunch of things, like you mentioned, maybe at one site, if you're so lucky, you find metal tools, daggers, household utensils like spatulas and carnelian beads. You find all those things, and you know those things. Like if you found them in my house, there's different stories that encompass those things. There's different interpretations. There's different contexts. So, I mean, the biggest thing that's important, and it's a bit more clerical, but it's so vital that we just record everything we find. Because the questions maybe that I'm interested in asking or you're interested in asking might be very different than maybe what Mike or someone else is asking of the record. And that's where the interpretation piece comes in. So for example, like you, let's say we discovered or like we uncovered all of these things, the discovery process or the analysis and interpretation process, that's kind of where, you know, that's where that why comes in. So like if you're interested in spatulas and the global history of spatulas or the Omani history of spatulas or food items, then that part of what's uncovered is going to be really interesting to you. And you are probably going to want to make sure that like you have all the information needed for like your next article or book. Maybe when it comes to like water history, it could be the carnelian beads that are most of interest to Mike for a certain question or paper, or for myself as well. Like if I'm interested in like, okay, gems or like precious stones or people using and why, that could be that part. So that's kind of the interesting balance that I think archaeologists have to strike. That's vital. That is, I'm not sure what I'm going to uncover, so I need to be a good steward of the archaeological, you know, record and like record things diligently, make sure they're preserved. But then I'm going to carve out like this piece of what I'm finding to really like hone in on, because that's my area of interest. So it's just being like this larger steward to like the entire record of what you're uncovering, but then also like having a bit of fun and, you know, uncovering like the stories through interpretation of what you're interested in. So.
Okay. That totally makes sense. And now all I want to know is when you guys are going to go discover spatulas so I can come along. So that totally makes sense. I guess it's everyone's interest and what is most important at that time to be working on, or what the reason why you're digging up a place. That's really fascinating. And I'm actually just, now I'm really fascinated to know why all of these things are there. So I guess that's maybe I need to change my careers. So kind of on that note, in a broader landscape of things, like I assume an archaeologist job is never done. Is there so much more to discover in this world? Will an archaeologist job ever be done?
No, to put it bluntly, no, there's definitely tons more to discover. And even if you go with my kind of definition of discovery, where it's like quite collaborative, where it's definitely a process. And it's that interpretation angle that I think kind of ensures that our job will never be done. Let's say we dug up everything, you know, or we've uncovered everything, we found every site, that the ways you can interpret the materials are almost endless. It really depends, like, the framing of the questions. I mean, just think about, like, if someone, like, stumbled across, like, your living room. And, you know, even if you're a minimalist, that also says something, too. The different interpretations that they could have, some of them are maybe correct, but there also might be multiple interpretations that are valid, that, you know, there might be a lot of incorrect ones, but, like, you can still have, like, simultaneously, like, correct or valid interpretations of the same space or same object. And that's why I think, like, there will be endless work for us as archaeologists to do.
No, I totally agree. And I love that kind of aspect. If someone came into my mother's living room right now, yeah, they'd be here for hours questioning what type of person she was. Yeah. And everywhere right. She'd be. Yeah, that's definitely really fascinating. So kind of now drawing away from everything we discussed, more to you and mm-hmm. a few kind of quick fire questions.
Sure.
I mean, now having visited Oman, what was the thing that fascinated you the most? And is it what you expected from a Middle Eastern country?
That's really interesting. You know, I think for me, the diversity in the physical landscape was just something that I was astounded by in Oman, and I'm continued to be astounded by. I'm like, oh wow, there's just so much. And I mean, there's like caves, there's sand deserts, there's, you know, gorgeous mountainous regions, there's the coastal areas, there's the different wadi areas. And I think, you know, if you do a tour the first time, maybe in Oman, you're just kind of maybe awestruck, but I just feel so privileged that I can keep going back and just like discover for myself all this diversity in the landscape. So yeah, I think that's one thing that has just kind of piqued my interest that I was surprised by and continue to be surprised by over the years.
Oh, that's amazing. No, I love to hear that. It definitely is a special place in terms of mm-hmm. the physical kind of landscape. So this is probably a hard question as well, but what has been the most exciting thing you've ever found or explored throughout your archaeology career?
Ooh. This is really hard. So I'm going to keep it to Oman so I can like narrow the scope a bit more. You know, I honestly think so far it was doing my ethno-archaeological research alongside amazing Omani women collaborators. I just felt so privileged that I could like work alongside people who I consider my friends, and we could, you know, do this research together and also answer questions that they were interested, that I was interested in. And I just felt so privileged that I got to see into this world of Omani women who were, you know, growing plants, who were managing water, and I get to hear, you know, their perspectives, which I feel sometimes are maybe obscured or not at the forefront in, you know, a lot of our interpretations. And I mean, this is an issue in the archaeological record in general, like more broadly, we saw in like the 1980s and 90s kind of this pushback in archaeology about like, hey, like, where are the women in the archaeological record? There's this assumption of like man the hunter. There is literally a conference called Man the Hunter. And it just I just felt so privileged to be able to hear those perspectives and, you know, hopefully in the coming years, like publish them in a way alongside my Omani women colleagues that contributes important information and perspectives about the role that women played in and continue to play in like farming, agriculture, gardening, and water. It's definitely it's this nuanced understanding that, you know, I think we're only like scratching the surface of now. So I don't know if that's technically like a discovery, but it's just something I just feel very privileged and grateful to be a part of. Not all pop culture, but like sometimes there's this impression that like archaeologists, like we find things and like we like keep these secrets, and it really like we cannot keep secrets. it would be out. That's a bit too much coordination. But I think there's something to be said for, you know, building trust and building relationships amongst people and having this shared curiosity about the past, and then, you know, getting to embark on like doing work alongside people you just really enjoy collaborating with, that like you've built friendships with, and like just learn more information. So that's been my favorite part so far of my work in Oman.
I love it. No, that was a perfect answer. And finally, what is the one piece of advice you would give to someone who's looking to become an archaeologist?
That's a good question. So I do, like, I'll put a bit of a shameless plug. I do have a website called Habits of a Traveling Archaeologist, and I do have a very long piece on tips for undergraduate students interested in archaeology. Now, I will say, especially in a country like Oman, where the archaeological training and practice is growing, I think in general, it's really good to kind of investigate for yourself your why. We talked about this why a lot. Like, so, and this is not to put anyone off of archaeology, but it's one, thinking about like why you're interested in becoming an archaeologist. And then also, you know, realizing there's different ways to be connected to the archaeological record and also to be an archaeologist. I'm a prime example of that. Like I did kind of the academic route, and now I'm doing this very non-traditional, uncharted route. So I'm not deterring anyone from being an archaeologist, but there's different ways to also engage with archaeology that, you know, maybe fit like whatever your why is. So I just would tell people to keep that in mind. But of course, feel free to reach out to me directly. It's a bit of a small world, especially in Omani archaeology. So I'm happy to get anyone interested, connected, or, you know, route them to the right person, or, you know, offer any advice that I can, because I think those questions are typically very person specific.
Yeah, no, definitely. Oh, well, thank you so much, Smriti. And I mean, if anyone does want to get in contact with you, where is the best kind of place to direct them to?
So I would give you two or three options. Social media is one. So I'm on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram. You're welcome to DM me there. And then the second option I would say is you can just go on to my website, like Habits of a Traveling Archaeologist, and you can go to the contact page and you can just fill in that. Ask your question there and I'll respond. So
amazing.
So one of the two.
That is perfect. Well, thank you so much, Smriti, for doing this podcast. It's been really fascinating. I've definitely learned a lot. And it's really nice. It's, as an Omani, it's really nice to actually discover things about Oman that, you know, we thought we knew or we actually never knew existed. So thank you for all the work you do. And thank you for doing this.
Oh, no problem. Thank you so much for having me. And I hope to venture to your area in the near future.
Yes, please.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get in contact with Smriti, please do drop us a message and we can connect you. And if you'd like to learn more about the society, please head to ao-soc.org. And we look forward to welcoming you next week.